The Cambie Report was recorded on the traditional and unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Today is January 19th, 2020, and in Vancouver earlier this week, 34 centimeters of snow fell in 5 days. In St. John's, 74 centimeters of snow fell in one. This is the Cambie Report. So, happy 2020, everyone. It is fantastic to be back. We have some wonderful new changes happening in the new year. We are very excited about them. And perhaps most importantly, before everything, we would like to remind you to give us money at patreon.com/CambieReport.
Make it rain!
It's what keeps the show going. It's why we're able to produce it, host it, edit it, have a nice-ish studio. It's decent.
It's very small.
So patreon.com/CambieReport.
You haven't even, like, experienced how warm the studio gets after
a full recording. I haven't.
No.
Speaking of which, who is this strange voice you're hearing?
Well, I'm Ian Bushfield.
I'm Matthew Naylor.
And today we're excited to introduce
Tessa Vikander.
Tessa, this is an exciting time. We're bringing you on. Well, you're in a bit of a flux period. You are one of the, I hesitate to use the word refugees from Star Metro's December implosion, but one of the many talented journalists they had that they've decided they don't need, which is, I guess, our gain for the time being.
Yeah, exactly. I am now a free agent. I like to call myself a hot piece of liberated talent, available for hire. So here I am. I'm doing a few episodes with you folks. We'll be sitting on the panel with you too for a couple of episodes, and then I'll also be doing a few interview episodes where it's me and another person.
We're really looking forward to those.
Yeah.
I definitely want to get listener feedback on what they think, how they go, what else they want to hear about, because I think you're open to pitches or ideas of what people want to hear.
Yeah, and so I'm going to be responding to what our listeners want to hear. And one of the great things that I bring into my journalism is an ability to bring in a diversity of voices. So I'm really excited to be bringing in people who are from a variety of different marginalized communities in the city and bring their stories to light as well here.
We're all looking forward to that.
Yes. And one thing that we are definitely looking forward to as well is the clearing of the streets. Snowpocalypse has beset Vancouver, and may I just say, before proceeding onward, Vancouver Press, really, Snowpocalypse, this word, this laziest portmanteau of them all, it's not a...
Well, last year was Snowmageddon.
Oh my god, that's almost worse. But it's
you had a better one.
Yes, the demon buses of Sleet Street was what I thought of when I saw 12, 14, I think, up to...
That infamous Daily Hive photo of all the buses lined up down Granville because they couldn't get up the hill.
Mm.
And I believe them because I was driving home on Wednesday and I managed to make it halfway up the street that my building is located on before my car started to spin, not like out of control, just like not in control. And I managed to back it into a snowbank where it resides to this day. Because I left a light on, it is now dead.
So I think this brings up the first political question about the snow, because we could sit here and complain about bad Vancouver drivers
as long as we want.
Boy, howdy, can we.
But one thing that inevitably comes up anytime there's snow is about priorities from the city. You know, what's being shoveled, what's being plowed, what's being done first. It does get a bit tired because it's always this drivers versus cyclists versus pedestrians again of like, why are the bike lanes being plowed but not the roads, or why are those being plowed but not the sidewalks? And it's like, it's all important.
We also have bike lane plowers that can't plow roads.
They're smaller mini Zambonis.
I really think that those bike lane plowers should be on sidewalks. Like, I just feel like most people are not gonna bike in the snow. There's gonna be a few people, and the few people who really want to bike in the snow, like, I don't know, go bike on the sidewalk or something.
I mean, there is a reduction in the mode share for cycling, but it is the business owner or residential property owner's responsibility to clear their fucking sidewalk. So clear your fucking sidewalk. Otherwise, you are bad.
I definitely you know, that is the law. And I almost wonder if sometimes that's not enough because there are blocks around me where there's empty lots and they haven't been plowed. And
Absolutely.
It's like, is it better for the city to chase them to with tickets to eventually have them plow it, or should the city just plow it and then send them the bill?
Oh, that would be nice. I like that.
I like the latter one.
All right.
Because it makes the situation go away. One thing that does need to be addressed is plowing outside city properties for like Parks Board, because the local park around my community is not plowed on any of its sides.
I did see...
Sorry, you expect the park to be plowed of snow during a snowstorm?
No. I expect the sidewalks around the park to be plowed of snow.
Ooh.
I.e. the business that the park board is running to be plowed of snow, as a business owner should.
Ooh.
And instead I had to do this lovely little, like, you know, dance with people going up and down the single lane of crushed snow that was produced for this.
That's like Montreal all winter.
And it's not just and it's not just a convenience issue for the three of us who are fairly able-bodied, and it's just annoying to trudge through snow, but like, I have a baby now, and pushing a stroller has just become like, well, I guess we're driving to the mall that's like 10 minutes away because I don't want to deal with questionable sidewalks, let alone people with disabilities and others who still need to get around but become suddenly socially isolated with 2 inches of snow.
I saw a senior on a power chair trying to get from, I guess, from his house down to a clinic in the downtown east side, trying to get through the snow. I think that was back on Tuesday or Wednesday when it was quite deep. And he was with another person, and I really wish that person he was with had had a shovel, because the route that he was trying to get through was not properly shoveled, which was very disappointing to see. But also just the fact that, like, he had to go on the road in the middle of the snow, like, it was a nightmare watching, and I wish that I could have helped him, but I really had to, I was running downtown to report on Meghan Markle, so I had to keep going.
The most important of stories.
The most important
that we
of
do
stories.
Not have in today's agenda.
I mean, duty calls. We'll see when they actually buy a house in Deep Cove.
What do you think Deep Cove?
I think it's going to be Deep Cove. It's like far away enough that it's still private. I'm somehow shoehorning royal watching into this episode, but I don't know. Was Earl Camby? Who was Camby? Was he?
I don't have that.
I don't know. We actually had this in our first episode. We should probably check up on this at some point, but. Like, they were looking at places in Victoria. They had that manse in Victoria over Christmas. And then they were staying in Deep Cove, which is, like, far enough away to still maintain privacy, but close enough to a major city and airport to, you know, do their semi-royal, semi-official duties.
Well, one place you can't easily get to is Deep Cove by transit. And we did actually have a listener try to reach out and ask a question that I did put to TransLink because I tried to do real journalism. I guess I kind of failed, though. They wanted to know, essentially, in this past week, there have been a ton of delays on SkyTrain that have varied in magnitude from, like, your train's a little slow to the system is shut down. And he basically wanted to know, in a lot of the snow, it seemed like TransLink was just reducing service on the SkyTrain. His issue was, if you can run trains, why can't you run all the trains? Which I thought was a reasonable question. I put that to TransLink, but unfortunately they only answered to me about yesterday's issues, or Wednesday's issues, sorry, that there was ice buildup on the power rails and that causes delays. But they have trains running all night on some of these to prevent snow and ice buildup. So there's your 24-hour train, just empty trains running back and forth.
My suspicion is that TransLink workers were themselves delayed getting to the works yard, and therefore there aren't enough trains.
That's possible. That would make sense. I think you might also, just out of safety, not wanting to be running too many trains if there's a chance any of them could slip.
Yeah.
Wait, the train slipping on the tracks?
I mean,
if it's icy.
Train slipping on the tracks. I mean, icy train tracks actually usually just break the ice. It's a buildup of pectin and then leaf matter on top of pectin that tends to make train tracks very, very slippery.
You sound like a train expert.
I have watched a very particular YouTube video. yeah, it does. Yeah, guy smeared jam all over a sheet of steel, let it dry, and then put some leaves on top of it, and then jumped in his galoshes on top of it and slid a great distance. It was... really
this sounds
astounding.
Like a YouTube rabbit hole.
Yeah,
it's great.
The other question TransLink faced this past week is whether it was potentially insensitive to tell commuters to just stay home if they could, rather than just kind of point out what the delays were. The argument being there's a lot of people on minimum wage jobs or who are tight on money who just can't afford to take a day off. So maybe it's TransLink's place not to be judging their choices.
Now, do we know, like, was TransLink saying, like, we recommend you that you go home if you can? Or were they just saying, go home, everyone, go home?
It was if those who do not have to travel should not travel.
That's what they said?
Yes.
Okay, and then people kind of paraphrase it as TransLink is telling everyone to go home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, stay at work if you can, apparently. TransLink's
set up camps.
Yeah. For me, it always seems a little ridiculous because you must in Calgary. It is required, and people don't know how to pulse their tires here, and they don't know how to use their handbrake to make the turns correctly, and everyone crashes into one another. So I guess we do need
the maybe Saturday. Maybe part of climate change adaptation in Vancouver includes providing low cost driving lessons for how to drive in the snow. Because I would like those lessons personally.
I was lucky to grow up in Alberta, and my lessons were in January. I mean, I got out.
Burn on Alberta. Okay.
I mean, this does, of course, create the situation where we can address the eventual symptoms of the no-snow apocalypse. I want to mention one more thing on snow removal, and that is that, like, beyond the bike lanes being plowed first off, no, they're not plowed first. They are plowed whenever the bike lane snowplow machine gets to it. They are different systems. Secondly, there is compacted ice and snow because a bunch of very heavy vehicles drove over early pack ice and snow, making it into a solid and unplowable substance. That's why there's snow on the roads. They haven't not been plowed. They were just used by the traffic that is customarily using them. Also, yes, plow side streets first, according to Sweden.
According to Sweden?
Yes. A gender-based study of traffic patterns indicated that women will typically make a series of shorter trips around communities during a, like, major snow event, compared to men who will typically make the standard daily commute on highways. But you can help more people by plowing the side streets first, because those things have to be, like, used throughout the day, rather than by plowing the highways, which are technically used by more people, but are used at two separate and, like, mid-plowable points during the day.
Got it.
This is perhaps a good time to mention that one of the many benefits to our Patreon channel is the Slack channel, and that is where that tidbit of information or inspiration for it at any rate came from. So yes, again, patreon.com/cambyreport.
Can you tell us what you mean a bit more about that Slack channel?
Yes, I mean patreon.com/cambyreport.
Slack channel is a discussion forum we have for all the supporters of the show. We also invite guests and past guests of the show in there so that you can have a discussion. We haven't sent you an invite, Tessa. We'll send that to you this afternoon, so you'll hopefully be in there before the episode is even online. We've recently merged it with the Politicoast Slack, the partner podcast to this. So there are provincial political watchers, federal provincial watchers, local political watchers, all in there geeking out over politics.
And policy.
Lots of policy talk.
So much policy.
And random crap they find on Reddit.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, from the snow, and we talked about the buses getting stuck in the snow, but one of the buses that I think actually did pretty well in the snow was the new Rapid Bus series.
Da-da-da!
Rapid Bus is here. So, TransLink has rebranded the 99, 98, 97, 96, etc. B-lines.
Except the 99 is actually still the 99.
Are you fucking kidding me?
I wish.
Yeah.
It will eventually be Rapid Bus.
Will it?
Or no, it might actually just
SkyTrain. It's just going to become SkyTrain. And they're saying that, we're expecting the SkyTrain Broadway line to be completed by 2025, so we're not updating the B-line. And I'm just like, we all know that's not going to happen. That's going to be 2030. Okay? It's going to be 2030.
Sadly.
I mean, knock on wood. I mean, I don't want that to be true, but yeah.
So anyway.
That is so fucking aggravating.
There are five rapid buses, one going down King George Boulevard, one down the Lougheed Highway, one down 41st Ave, and one down Hastings. Sorry, there's four. There's not actually an R2.
There's no R2?
There's D2.
What? What's D2?
R2-D2. He's from Star Wars. They didn't want to confuse you.
Really?
I don't know.
Oh, but it's like R1, R3, R4, R5.
I mean, that sounds like a note that would come out of a focus group.
Absolutely, it does.
So these four buses were telegraphed in advance by TransLink as improvements to existing express bus lines. And I think there was a lot of skepticism in advance about, is this just a rebranding for the sake of rebranding? Because that's what it looked like.
From the outside, that's deeply what it looks like.
But it sounds like they've actually managed to speed them up, increase the speed, and deliver on the promises. And the welcome of it feels like it's been, or, you know, the reception feels like it's been overwhelmingly positive.
The question is, how have they done this?
So they've done a number of things. Number one, they did redo all the stops. So the stops do have bright, big signs with digital displays of when the next buses are come with some local wayfinding. That doesn't improve the bus itself, but it improves the experience.
Fewer people stepping onto the street being like, oh, look, I'm going to step out onto the street to see if the bus is coming.
That doesn't
hurt. You just know it's coming in 3 minutes.
I am very pleased to have information, provider telling me exactly how much of my life I'm going to waste waiting for the next bus. Of course, I live on Maine, so that doesn't work anyway.
They've done a number of other things, really improved the infrastructure. So they worked with the cities to set light times to really work with the buses, better labeled bus transit ways. So especially along 41st Ave, it's almost all bus lane down that right lane, or the outside lane, both ways, wherever it's 6 lanes wide. It's really just giving right of ways and helping shave every second off they can, because one of the challenges they've had is buses are getting stuck in traffic too much. And even though traffic seems to have been flatlining, bus times have been slowing down, and this seems to have reversed it. And then they also just put more buses on.
Wait, do we know for sure that it has reversed it, or that's the plan?
That's what it seems like it's starting to. There's already data
coming in on that.
The initial data indicates, because this is all done via an openly accessible Google API.
That you've both looked at?
I have looked
at people...
Sorry,
that's amazing to me that you've both looked at the open access data.
People who have looked at the open access data because...
I haven't looked at it.
Okay.
But they indicate that the initial reports, which is not a large enough to be a representative sample of the operation of the bus over a year, are quicker than the bus was previously.
I need to correct a record because we're going to get tweets and emails. There is an R2 bus line. It doesn't exist yet. It's going to be on Marine Drive in North Van, and it's the one that will connect West Van and North Van. I believe that's...
Oh, the one that isn't allowed to go...
Past the border of West Van.
Okay, of course.
Essentially, there was a large debate last year from West Vancouverites who said, we don't need dedicated bus lanes because all of us
because
drive.
Because our children will die because they can't understand how to get out of the way of vehicles.
It was bad. It was
driving on a road near a school.
There's a joke to be made about R2... being detoured? R2 detour. Yeah.
Yes. And I certainly hope that everyone can have the faith that had that been the branding for that bus line at the time, we really would have made it.
Okay, but here's a question about the branding of the rapid bus. It seems a little bit risky because what happens when it's not rapid, when it really slows down? Everyone's going to be like, the rapid bus is not rapid.
Make it a SkyTrain.
Oh, and...
Because then it's just the sky. The train is in the sky. It doesn't make any sense anyway. Why should we expect it to come?
I mean,
are you saying that the bus
just
lines should be
literally
replaced by SkyTrains?
Yeah, unless we have a bus street like Brisbane's Queen Elizabeth Mall that is for buses and buses alone to congregate the buses of the rapid
Ottawa
bus
has route. Or had that too.
Yeah,
right?
It has a.
They're
yeah.
fine, but
fine.
Not, yeah, but not a particularly long. I think that fine. It was how my professor pronounced it, but they managed to accept that many buses, and certainly more buses than any other street of such an area would be able to accept under other circumstances. But they still fill up and are subject to the same limitations of vehicle traffic, even though there are fewer particles, which is that stop start, how many buses can get through a light at a time aspects, and so there end up being delays because of bus congestion.
Well, it's also easier to electrify a SkyTrain, which it is, than the buses. We are rolling out some electric buses, and TransLink is piloting some really cool fast power charging systems around the city for buses. But that infrastructure is big, expensive, cumbersome, and new. But SkyTrain's pretty well established. It just costs a lot to build it. One thing I have noticed, though, about Rapid Bus, and I think this might be the last thing I have to say on it, is just the way they've helped roll it out, I think, is going to help develop more transit-mindedness in the city, because it's been branded and put on all of the major route line maps. So rather than just seeing the SkyTrain map, you now see, oh, there's a connection at Joyce Collingwood for the, for, you know, UBC. The rapid bus,
right.
For the UBC rapid bus. And that kind of hint is like, maybe helps people think of it in terms of, oh, I can take the SkyTrain to the rapid bus and I can get to UBC, instead of just, oh, I have to take a bus. Because I know there's times when I've even been like, oh, if I have to transfer to a bus, and I like buses most of the time, but it feels like extra work. But as soon as it feels like...
I mean, it 100% is extra work.
Well, yeah. But if you're transferring from like SkyTrain line to SkyTrain line, that's not so bad because you figure it's still quick and smooth. And now that it's highlighted, it's like a psychological barrier that hopefully drops a little bit.
Yeah, okay. If you have to transfer from C-bus to funicular to gondola and then back again, it's
this perceived. Podcast is on record of fully supporting the SFU gondola.
Yep.
Once you've taken the bus up SFU, you know it needs a gondola.
Yep, that's fair. I generally don't go up to SFU for that very reason.
I don't since I graduated.
Gotcha.
But let's switch to the other big data project that came out in this last week. The Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation released its annual rental report, the big listing of how many rental units are available across the country. No one was really surprised that Vancouver still does not have much rental.
Wah, wah.
It's almost like we're not building enough homes. Build more homes, Vancouver.
So we'll get into a note on that.
Is it just about building homes or is it about building rental homes?
I mean...
The eternal question.
Well, I mean, the papers of record appear to have answered it, at least in some degree, by showing that vacancy taxes work by converting a lot of basically empty homes or Airbnbs into long-term rentals.
Yeah, so what they found is there's been an additional 11,118 units, an increase of 19% almost across Metro Vancouver in the last year, which one CMHC spokesperson, according to Justin McElroy, attributed to, quote, investor owners increasing their involvement in the long-term rental market, which is the most awkward way of saying they filled their empty homes.
But is it that they've filled their empty homes or have they just put them out on the market?
They've at least put them on the market.
Okay.
Because this is only counting how many rental units exist.
Right, right.
I guess it all on the vacancy rate. Notably, the report says that the average rent for a two-bedroom unit in the region has gone from $1,649 to $1,748. So,
in response, I thought, you can get a standard two-bedroom unit in Vancouver for $1,649?
No, that would have been last year. $1,748 would be this year.
And once you get out to Langley...
Can you get a two-bedroom in Langley for $1,748?
My suspicion is that this is a lot of historical rents have been factored into this. This isn't the cost of a new unit.
That's true, probably, as well. The people who've been in the same unit for much longer have a better rent than if you try to switch. So that will skew it.
We also appear to have increased our number of condominium apartments by what is frankly a fucking staggering 18.9%. That's across the region, but still, holy shit.
Yeah, that's what the analysts are saying is partially attributable to the vacancy taxes.
We built homes and let people live in them.
Yeah, but also the vacancy taxes and incentives to not leave them off the market.
That's what I mean. I feel that's folded into the and let people live in them.
Yeah. It also still varies by type of unit. Bachelors are at 0.7%, one beds are at 1%, and two beds are at 1.5%. And it's just 1% for, I think, three or more rooms. So different rates for different sizes of family, I guess, or what you're seeking. None of them are near what many consider a healthy 2% vacancy rate where it becomes reasonable to try to find a home. So still a lot more for the city, province, federal government, developers, everyone to do to fix this.
Excellent. Well, build more homes. And one of the places that you have to convince to build more homes is, of course, Vancouver City Council. Their zoning reviews will very strongly contribute to the amount of new homes, new housing that is built in Vancouver. So not only on that, but on every other issue, you know, please conduct a instant, broad-based, multifactorial analysis on everyone's performance over the last year. Ian?
Yeah. No. It's such a complicated council, right? We've talked about this continually, but I thought it was worth revisiting, you know, who are these players? How are they doing? And what are we watching for in the next year? The end of 2019 saw the NPA somewhat implode as Rebecca Bly quit the party amid this like alleged far-right takeover of the party's board, people connected to Rebel Media and other, you know, rather radical extreme groups for kind of the consensus of what Vancouver politics is, which leaves the rest of the NPA elected councillors who notably don't actually have to care what the board says. They don't.
They are not beholden to the board. They cannot be fired by the board. They could be not renewed as candidates by the board, but that won't be for several...
A couple more years.
Years, yes.
So within the remaining NPA caucus, you have Melissa DeGenova, who's kind of the become one of the elder statespeople of Vancouver City Council, been there quite a while. You have Lisa Dominato, Sarah Kirby-Young, and Colleen Hardwick. And Colleen Hardwick is such the odd duck of that group, as the other three relatively younger women seem to be working with the rest of council on different issues to try to build more stuff, pass zoning. Still, they're still the NPA.
And remind people that taxes are a thing.
Exactly. They're still the NPA.
Yeah.
Hardwick is with them on that. But Hardwick has taken, I think, the strongest voice on council against new developments anywhere, particularly in her zones, but really taking that... Let's keep the city the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
For whom?
For whom we are today and no one else.
And now we also look at Rebecca Bly, who is going in as an independent. I'll encourage people to listen back to the interview Matthew and I did with her in December, which was a pretty good episode. She still sides with the rest of her caucus, I think, on a lot of ideological issues, but it just...
Yeah, that's because Rebecca Bly was the second most right-wing member of the NPA caucus. Like, other than Colleen Hardwick. Yeah, like, she was a... The NPA had effectively no political positions on social issues, really, of any kind, other than, like, a broad pro-Soji education or Soji 123 stance at the school board level. And, I don't know, Suzanne Anton had voted to keep the Odyssey open way back in the day. They hadn't really taken any position for like a social dimension that wasn't really open in Vancouver politics. And now we've decided to open it up because a third dimension will allow a sequel to Ian and Stewart's paper.
You're referencing the work we did on the right-left spectrum versus the preservationist conservation, the urbanists and people who don't want to change the city and trying to look at politics in a different way. And one of the other parties that's equally complicated on that question are the Greens, where I feel like there are three Green parties in the city of Vancouver representing each of the three elected Green councillors.
Yeah, and the Greens, as with many things in life, come out to a two-thirds moral hazard, one-third good breakdown, where each of them together adds up to a Green party that is altogether two-thirds moral hazard, one-third good. A lot of moral hazard in the Adrian Carr camp with a very conservationist ethic respecting development. Pete Fry seems to come up as a bit of a 50-50, like...
There's some things I'm really, like, excited to see from Pete Fry, and then there's other things that kind of leave me scratching my head.
He's very much the Anthony Kennedy of the Vancouver City Council.
I still like the guy. And Mike Wiebe is, I think, possibly our favorite of the Greens.
Yeah, at least in terms of you and I, Matthew. yeah, especially in terms of like their general voting attitude towards development projects, which I think we also probably can say we could agree that is the primary issue of Vancouver's current civic discourse.
That leaves the other two councillors, Christine Boyle, who continues to advance
basically. One councillor.
Yeah, she is advancing everything she promised to, whether it's supporting a step towards affordable rentals, wherever that can be, through different pilot projects that the city is working on, but also trying to bring up social justice issues. She's been really big on pushing the city on reconciliation. She's been big on pushing the city on climate. I also enjoy her social media game. She pointed out this past week that she tried to cross-country ski to work to council and actually had difficulty because too many people had plowed their sidewalks, which is a good problem to have.
It is a good problem to have.
No, it's a weird problem to have. It's like, I'm going to do something that if people had obeyed the law will be impossible. Hooray.
Whenever I think of anyone trying to cross-country ski through Vancouver, all that happens is, like, in my mind, I just cringe because I'm, like, worried about the stones.
Weird problem, great photo op.
That's yeah, yeah. It's just, like, ruining your skis, basically, yeah. Like what you're setting out to do, it seems.
I really have to hope she has, like, a backup pair, and this was just the, like...
Totally.
Yeah, let's just trash them.
Photo op skis, yeah.
But beyond the cross-country skiing, I think Christine Boyle has done quite a decent job on council. She speaks well to the issues she's passionate about and is making sure to be a voice for different communities at council. In much the same way that Jean Swanson's also being a voice for many, many communities, specifically on issues relating to the downtown east side, to marginalized communities. Both of them worked really well together on the expropriation of the Balmora and the other Sahota property.
Real.
On the other hand, Swanson's also been a bit of a wild card where she'll side with Colleen Hardwick on the opposite side of the political spectrum to oppose developments. In Swanson's opinion, they tend to just not be affordable enough. And I think...
They aren't affordable enough. That doesn't mean we shouldn't build them.
It's the letting the perfect be the enemy of the good kind of situation that I think a lot of people were afraid would happen if she were elected.
The new developments aren't going to be affordable. They are going to be unaffordable for... Well, I mean, like, two-thirds of Vancouver lives in unaffordable housing because that is how our very fucked up housing system works with respect to CMHC guidelines. But, they aren't going to be affordable. They still will make the overall market more affordable, which is, I think, the sort of short-sighted aspect of her thinking.
And then the big issue with this very divided, split, multiple different ways council is they don't have a coherent way to bring forward. So everyone's little pet issues are being picked up, which many of them are valuable and important issues, but as came up with the budget consultations in December, suddenly means property owners need to be hit with like an 8%, 9% property tax increase to afford everything. And that starts to irk people who go, why are you spending so much money on all of these different issues when you should just be picking up the garbage? Which I think's a bit of a narrow view of what a city should do, but...
It's a very privileged view of what a city should do as well, because that's anyone with that point of view is suggesting that they don't need kind of extra support that might come from the state.
I guess, yeah. No, I don't disagree with that. I mean, just the challenge is, at some point, the city can't do everything.
Absolutely not.
Trying to figure out how to balance those tensions. Like I spoke with Alex Hemingway on the podcast just before the new year, you know, there is a case to be made that property taxes could be much, much higher and help the city afford to do everything. But, you know, hitting people with 9% property tax increases every year is going to cause, it might just be a rich person revolt, or, you know, landed homeowner revolt, but politicians need to be aware of that because they will get kicked out of office if they piss too many people off.
Yeah, it's also like a lot of money. I mean, it's something that you'd have to really budget for in your life if you're a homeowner.
On the plus side, it does help people understand the mill rate, which, you know, is one of the overarching policy goals of the Canby Report.
What I think we're looking for, though, to lead the city and this divided council was a very strong mayor with a vision. But Kennedy Stewart, in many ways, has kind of just come across as the guy just trying to make sure everyone gets along without, like, he hasn't really stood out in the last couple years. Not for good or bad. He's just kind of been like in the background. Maybe that's a positive step for many people who were frustrated at Gregor Robertson's at time over partisanship. But I wonder if we don't need stronger leadership. You know, like a visionary kind of thing.
What is the point of a mayor in a weak mayor system? That's a question that every mayor has to answer for themselves, as with really anyone in any circumstance in every situation ever. But like, do we think that the mayor is doing all that their office and title could, through soft power, entitle them to do, rather than just the administrative hard power aspects of the job that Kennedy Stewart seems to have seized with both hands? I would suggest no.
Like, reportedly there is a lot he's done behind the scenes to build consensus and make sure things do get passed, but I think there is a frustration in the city. And you know, when we look at what's coming up, the citywide plan that the council is trying to put together, like, what will the city look like over the next
several
future
decades?
Yeah. You know, all the major rezonings coming up. There's rezonings coming up this week that vary from one you noticed, Tessa, in the agenda.
Yeah, so there's a rezoning for a building next to the York Theater on Commercial Drive down near Hastings. So I was like, oh no, like another building in my neighborhood going down. So anyway, I clicked for more details on that and I was reading through. And finally, by page 5, I figured out what was going on. And it's that Café Latana, which is this cute little kind of Parisian cafe there, wants to be able to serve alcohol. So they want a liquor license. And in order for them to get a liquor license, they actually have to rezone the entire building so that the building can be a space for like mixed commercial use, I think, and instead of whatever else it was.
It was probably light commercial or light industrial, like the shops around there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like a huge complicated
But it's still change, a rezoning,
but it's a rezoning, course. Which is like multi pages of paper.
And that one's unlikely to be controversial, we hope, because being able to serve a drink seems relatively harmless. Like, alcohol has its problems, but...
Yeah, but in Vancouver, serving a drink is not harmless anywhere, it seems.
Yeah. So...
Even on the beach.
There are much more complicated rezonings. One of the other ones that's going to public hearings this week is Lululemon's proposed new office building.
Oh, I missed that.
I believe this is going... It might have been in one of the... not the regular council, but one of the public hearings, because they're having a couple other meetings this week. And... because of the way these are written, it's not always written in the headline, and it's easy to miss. But Lululemon wants to put up its new office tower, I believe, near VCC Clark. And
oh, in East Vancouver?
Yeah, and so that one's going to generate some controversy.
That's off-brand. Lululemon belongs in the West Side, I'm just saying. Like, as someone who grew up in the West Side, like 15 blocks from the very first Lululemon, I really believe that it belongs in Kitsilano.
I mean, that it's on point.
Yeah, it's not wrong. And so that one's likely to attract more controversy, as well as, you know, a number of the rental projects that get rezoned. And stewarding these projects through, as we've seen in the last year, has gotten more and more unwieldy as the speakers lists grow and people are exercising properly their right to speak for or against something. Yes.
Yeah.
But at some point, I believe they've spent 40, 50 hours on one rezoning that amounted to like 10 or 15 units. And it's like, is this a good use of anyone's time?
It was 6 years that Scott calculated as being the amount of time that Vancouver Council would have to sit in open session, like without breaks, meals or washrooms, to pass enough houses or units to meet their goals from the last election.
Well, let's get going then.
Yeah. So,
and then beyond the housing issues, there's the continuing opioid epidemic and health overdose effects being felt across the city. Climate change continues to be a major threat to Metro Vancouver and the world. And there's just a lot more that needs to be done. And it feels like things are still slow in the city that needs revolution.
Mm-hmm. But I think that just because council meetings might be going slowly, it doesn't mean that necessarily all of the work behind the scenes is going as slowly.
Yeah, there are definitely tons of actors outside of
City
council. And
yes.
The activists and people on the street.
Well, yeah, but also just
more,
like,
but
I just
staff
mean staff.
Yeah.
Like, there's tons of staff at city, like in the city and on various committees that are, you know, quite likely moving ahead quickly with their work as well.
Antigonish is an 1899 poem by American educator and poet William Hughes Mearns. I have paraphrased it here. Yesterday, I met the mayor. I met a mayor that wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. It seems like he has gone away. When I saw a fallen tree, the man was standing there for me. But when I started the roll call, his stances weren't clear at all. Go away. Go away. Don't you come back anymore. Go away. Go away till you address the poor.
Well, one issue Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart needs to step up and address as both mayor and chair of the Vancouver Police Department board is a story that came out at the end of December and early January where Bella Pella man Maxwell Johnson, who's Indigenous, and his granddaughter were going to the bank to do money stuff as
open
one does.
Open a bank account.
Yeah.
Open a bank account.
Very normal thing. On December 20th, and he gets arrested. And they both get arrested for being Indigenous in public, I guess. Well, that's not officially a crime.
No, no, they were
officially.
I mean, it has been a crime, but the official problem was a suspicious bank account or suspicion of fraud has occurred. What the BMO employee then did when they saw that the man in question had $30,000 in his bank account, the teller went and notified security. Security then proceeded apace through their apparently normal security protocols, which eventually led to this man sitting in the backseat of a squad car outside the BMO branch.
And so the story has been, or, you know, these moves have been roundly condemned correctly as an overreaction and not good, obviously. But where I think the question for this podcast comes in is, you know, what is the role of the mayor and what response should he be taking? I know that he did do some media on this where I believe he appeared on a morning show and spoke to it after a couple days, noting that, you know, BMO seems to have overreacted, but I believe he put up some defense for the Vancouver Police Department's actions, saying, you know, they're measured and whatnot. And it did note that inquiries need to be done, a review needs to happen, and that is being conducted. The VPD's actions will be reviewed by the Delta Police, which it's good when police don't directly investigate themselves, but I think I at least have some unease.
Trepidation,
that's a good word, when other police are still investigating police. And I don't know what the best solution here is. I mean, obviously not arresting people for opening bank accounts is a good start, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just want to point out with this story that Angela Starrett from CBC has been doing absolutely amazing reporting on it. Just looking through her Twitter feed here, and it's just like for days and days and days trying to get responses from BMO. And I remember she sent out a tweet and saying something like the story had over a million views, which is wild. It's just wild. Coming from, you know, being in various journalism newsrooms where, like, when a story does well, it gets maybe, at least within Canada, it gets, like, maybe 100,000 views in a day at most. And that's, like, huge. Normally it's, like, 60 to 90 in a day if it's a national huge story. 60 to 90,000, I'm saying.
Yeah.
I mean, that is interesting. It's wonderful having you here in particular because of the, like, inside the newsroom journalism knowledge that you can bring to this heretofore almost entirely amateurish podcast. Because, like, I would have thought that a million people seeing something across Canada would have not been actually that huge, but I don't know, 1 in 35 of us, I suppose, is quite a lot.
There's also a difference between, like, someone opening a link and reading a story versus someone hearing about something from other people.
True.
Right? Or just seeing the headline and a subhead on their Facebook.
Yeah.
So they might still know that it has happened and, you know, talk to friends about it having happened or read about it through CTV,
secondary,
for example.
Coverage.
Yeah. Yeah. She says more than a million views, tens of thousands of tweets, emails, messages, and calls. I didn't expect international coverage once I broke the story. All props goes to Maxwell Johnson for his bravery to help the world understand what some Indigenous people face in Canada, said Angela Starrett on January 12th over Twitter.
And I think that's one of the key points here is it's very easy to forget about the human at the center of this story, that, you know, the individual people who suffered this indignity and this, you know, affront to their just personhood, who are just trying to do very boring things. And just trying to do boring things, but being harassed or, you know, in some cases, literally arrested and thrown in a squad car is too real of a situation for far too many people. And, you know, the good news about this being picked up by a million people suggests there is some recognition that this is important and needs to stop.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because we, in looking at our show notes before coming here, you know, we're planning to, you know, bring up this issue and what happened. I actually have found it very, very hard to read about this story. Like, it makes me internally so angry. Like, I'm grateful that I actually haven't had to report on it because it's just, it's so difficult to talk about and hear about it. And yeah, actually, you know, that's an interesting thing about journalism. Sometimes that I find when I'm asked to report on something, I'm like less angry and less affected about it But when I'm not reporting on a story that's upsetting, I find it way more upsetting, if that makes sense. It's like once I'm getting into the work, I'm able to like...
Yeah,
I don't know.
You have to put on the hat.
Yeah, you put on your hat. It's a little different.
It's an analysis. Some of my clients I really like, and some of them are still very guilty. It's like...
Well, from that heavy topic to our last major news story of the episode, in North Vancouver, we've been covering, and specifically Justin McElroy has been doing some excellent in-depth journalism, which is a little, I hope, less personally taxing to cover. And this is the saga over the city's attempt to ban pigeons.
And yeah, what?
So just to quickly recap the story, the city brought forward a bylaw last year to ban people from keeping pigeons in their backyard as pets, which apparently was a thing. But actually, it turns out it was only a thing of the neighbors of one of the counselors. So one of the counselors, it turned out, was very disgruntled about the fact her neighbor had pigeons that kept shitting on her lawn. This has now raised a conflict of interest question about whether she misappropriately influenced and pressured other counselors to benefit herself, not financially, but pleasantly.
It still boils down effectively to property value, because that's where the conflict of interest comes in, because it theoretically would have increased the property value for there to not be pigeon shit on things.
But unfortunately, the attempt to review, at least at the BC Supreme Court, whether this is a conflict of interest is likely to fail, because to file this petition under the specific act that we're talking about, you need 10 valid co-signers from that district. And two of the 11 who signed this live in the city of North Vancouver, not the district of North Vancouver.
If ever there was a reason to amalgamate the North Vancouver's, I'd say that this is it.
And that's where this story is at.
The story is beautiful. Go read about it on the CBC with Justin McElroy's wonderful coverage so far. It is hilarious. The actions of the counselor were so clearly beyond the pale.
It is over something that so little matters, too.
Yeah, but it's the kind of thing, like, Mr. Smith goes to Washington, never really happens. It's always, I was angry about the pigeons, and then eventually became the president. Except in that one, I suppose it was people of races other than white.
Oh.
Yes. Anyway, Super Tuesday is coming up. Please keep that candle of hope alive until it is cruelly doused in November.
So, they're hoping to amend the suit in North Vancouver to include more district residents so they can actually test in the BC Supreme Court whether this counselor's actions violated the Conflict of Interest Act.
Like, there's a geographic boundary. Go door knocking. What on earth?
I think maybe some people don't know which North Vancouver they live in.
Oh, I imagine.
I'm just guessing. I'm just guessing. I don't know. But yeah. Speaking of birds, though, in cities, have we heard anything about Connect the Crow?
Dead.
Dead? Confirmed?
I think missing and presumed dead is the...
Okay.
Again, much to Justin McElroy's bird-related delight.
Was he anti-Canuck?
I mean, he did the Ambassador for Vancouver bracket, which ended up selecting Canuck the Crow, which he was not super pleased with, because, I mean, in abstract, what does a crow carrying a knife say about a city compared to Seth Rogen, which I actually feel is, you know, a chemically perfected instance of Vancouver that was just extruded for U.S. consumption.
Well, and with that, let us turn, as we always do at the end of these panels, to our Vancouverada, our random fact or instance of history about the city of Vancouver, and Metrovan in this case. I found a story that's somewhat related to the recent recent Supreme Court of Canada decision that was from the bench and unanimous that BC's reference question about whether it can restrict dangerous goods coming through pipelines or other means into the province to be unconstitutional. This was an attempt to block the Trans Mountain Pipeline. There was a story titled The Day Oil Rained Down on Burnaby from the Burnaby Now from a few years ago that really highlights, I think, why a number of North Burnaby residents are very paranoid about oil coming through their neighborhood. So The date was July 24th, 2007. At 12:31 p.m.,
Tom.
A 24-inch pipeline was punctured by an excavator. This led to a 25-minute-long spray of heavy crude oil into the air, which rained down over the neighboring blocks. 42 families, representing 101 people, had to be evacuated from the area. This was another 120 were also affected. This is a pipeline that went from the Kinder Morgan, you know, those crude oil tanks that you see on Burnaby Mountain, down to one of the docks.
I wonder how long the smell lasted for.
The story is quite detailed, and so I'll put the story in the show note links. One person who was there to clean up told the Now a couple years later, "That was a scene I will never forget. It was crude oil. It was very heavy and black. It was black as you could imagine, shooting up into the sky, at least 30 feet high, spraying onto roads and property, the landscaping and trees in all close vicinity. The whole road was just covered in black, and so were some of the fences and yards." There's photos in the article as well about like a dog having to wear booties so it wouldn't step on the oil and damage its feet. And the cleanup took quite a while. And so the day the oil rained down in Burnaby.
All right, cloudy with a chance of crude. And with that horrifying forecast, and also the one that I am apparently supposed to ride my bike in moments from now, this has been the January 19th, 2020 episode of the Canby Report. I am Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Tessa Vikander.
Just before we sign off, Tessa, tell people where they can find you and what super interesting thing you're working on this week.
So my Twitter handle is at Tessa Vikander. That's T-E-S-S-A. V-I-K, so that's like a Viking, A-N-D-E-R, at Tessa Vikander. And this week, I'm going to be reporting for Reuters News, and I'm going to be covering the Menglong Zhou trial for who is the chief financial officer for Huawei Telecom Company. Her extradition hearing is starting on Monday in Vancouver at the downtown Supreme Court. And that's a huge story that it's interesting because it's created a bit of a cottage industry for journalists. So yeah, follow me there.
We'll look forward to that.